We think of the David and Goliath story as a children's story, as a kid's story, as a Sunday school kind of story. In fact, as you listened to Pete read the reading, maybe you thought back to being a child and hearing the story. Or maybe you didn't. We're moving into a post-Christian world where biblical literacy is falling away. And maybe some of you haven't heard the story before, aren't familiar with the story. We think of it as a kid's story, as a children's story, but it isn't a children's story. That's not the role that it plays in Hebrew literature. It's not the role that it plays in this book. This is one of the pivotal stories in all of the Old Testament. Because it's with this story, you see, that the nation of Israel is introduced to David. We've been introduced to David as we read the story. We already know about David. In fact, we know more about David than David knows about David. But the Hebrew people haven't met David yet. This is their introduction to him. And so you have to understand some context to understand why this story is so important. 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, the two books that from which this reading is taken, tells the story of a big transition in Hebrew history. At the start of the story, there is no king in Israel. Samuel is the last of the judges. At the end of the story, Israel is a significant empire with a king and a capital, the city of Jerusalem. Samuel is the first of the judges. For quite a while, the Hebrew people experimented with a unique form of government in the ancient world. I say a unique form of government, no government. That's the experiment. No political structure at all. For a brief period of time, they experienced with the idea, how would you run a society if you didn't have any government? For quite a while, you see, there's no laws, the way that we think of speed limit laws, or legislative laws. There are moral laws about how you treat people, how you behave in society. There are ritual laws about how to offer sacrifices, how to go through ritual cleanings, those kinds of laws, but nothing like don't rip the tag off the mattress kind of laws. None of those kind of laws. There's no legislature, there's no Congress, there's no court system, there's no police officers, there's no king, there's no army, there's no government. Over and over again, as you read the book of Judges, you hear the phrase, everybody did what they thought was right. Everybody did what they thought was right. And the political theory here is interesting. The idea seems to be that if you raise children to know God's moral law, to know how to behave, if you teach children God's laws, and then when they grow up, they do what they think is right, well, then you don't need lawsuits. You don't need police officers on every corner. That's the idea. That's the experiment. It's an interesting theory. It's an interesting idea. It didn't work very well. It wasn't very effective. Because sometimes things happen where it would be nice to have a government. For example, when some of the people started to worship the pagan gods, it'd be nice to have somebody with some authority to say, you can't do that. It'd be nice to have an army when you're invaded. Then it would kind of be nice to have a government with an army. And the Hebrew people are going to find out they're going to be invaded an awful lot. And when they do, they go through a pretty ineffective process. The bad guys show up, start moving through the countryside, stealing stuff, burning stuff, killing people. And the Hebrew people have to wait until somebody jumps up and says, God's anointed me to be a judge. Let me unpack that sentence for you. When I say judge here, I don't mean this is a reference to an older use of the word that just means any leader who can make a decision, leaders who make decisions. So when I say judge, don't think about Judge Judy or Judge Joe Brown or somebody in a black robe banging the gavel. A different kind of judge, just a leader who makes decisions. Somebody stands up and says, God's anointed me to be a leader. That concept of anointing is central to understanding the Hebrew story. In fact, it's central to understanding the Christian story. That word anointed, in the English language, that English word anointed means chosen to do a special job. In this context, chosen by God to be the leader, to be the judge. But of course, not everybody who jumps up and says, God chose me to be the leader, is the leader. You can figure that one out. And so they go through a process. The candidate, let's call him, to be the judge, meets with some priests, some religious leaders, and they go back and forth. How do you know that God anointed you to be a judge? Because an angel showed up and told me? How did you know it was an angel? Ray handled kinds of angel magic tricks. Like what? Like this. And back and forth it goes. And sometimes these priests would say, "Nah, you're making all that up. Nah, get out of here. Go on home." And sometimes they would say, "No, you know, you sound like you really were called to be the leader, to be the judge." And when that decision is reached, then in front of representatives of all the people, the high priest takes just a little bit of oil and pours it on the head. When I say takes oil and pours on the head, don't think like 5 quarts of 10W40 or something. Just a little bit, maybe a tablespoon or something, pours it on the head. That might sound odd to us, but it's a symbol of blessing. We saw that in the psalm that we read. Remember, that if you think back that image of the oil dripping down off the head, it sounds kind of odd to us. But in that context, that's a great sign. And that's a symbol, you see, that someone's been anointed. The concept of oil becomes linked to the idea of anointed, so much so that even in the English language, the oint part of anointed is a reference back to oil. It comes from a Latin word that means oil, like ointment, medicine that's in an oil base, so when you have an injury, you put it where it's supposed to stick. The idea of oil is in the English word for anointed. The Hebrew word for anointed is interesting, is the Hebrew word Messiah. And in fact, the root of that Hebrew word Messiah is the Hebrew word for oil. You can remember that because if someone poured oil on your head, you'd be what? You'd be messy, right? The Greek word for anointed is the Greek word Christos, from which we get the English word Christ. And believe it or not, the root of the Greek word, Christ, the Chris part of the word, is the Greek word for oil. When you go to the grocery store to buy vegetable oil, one of the big brands is Crisco, right? Do you get it, how Crisco is a fancy way of saying the oil company? It's got the Greek word for oil, the Chris part, and then they add co onto the end. It's just interesting that the word oil forms the foundations of those words in all three of those languages. And one line of thought we would follow here could be how that concept of being chosen to do a special job over time, the Hebrew people develop into this longing for a Messiah coming in the future, for the Christ coming in the future, someone chosen to bring redemption to the entire nation. And then, of course, we'd get to Jesus. That'd be one line of thought from here. But I want to take a different line of thought here. Well, then you see the judge is anointed. Everybody recognizes the judge is anointed, let's put it that way. And so the judge begins to raise an army. He begins to appoint an officer corps. He begins to train the army. And then after a while, then he can take the army and start chasing the bad guys. Not very effective. And over time, there becomes this greater call from the Hebrew people. We want a king. You know, if we had a king and an army, it'd be a whole lot better when the bad guys showed up. And in fact, maybe they wouldn't show up so much if we had an army. Maybe the reason we're getting invaded all the time is that we don't have an army. Maybe it'd be nice to have an army. And besides, the Hebrew people said, well, we want to be like all the other countries. Everybody else has a king. We don't have a king. It's embarrassing not having a king. Travelers come through and say, well, this is a nice place. Who's your king? They said, well, we don't have one. Not good enough to have a king? We don't have one. It's embarrassing. We want to be like the other countries. Samuel, the last of the judges. I tell you, he's the last of the judges, so you kind of know where the story's going already. Samuel, the last of the judges, says to the people, you don't want a king. Look, I'm the judge. I'm the leader. Sounds like a good system to me. You don't need a king. And the people said, no, we want a king. And Samuel said, no, you don't want a king. Look, if you get a king, you're going to have to pay income taxes, and your son's going to be drafted into the army. He's going to take your daughters as servants in the palace. You don't want a king. Just leave things the way things are. And the people said, no, we want a king. And Samuel said, okay, you want a king. Let's see, who'd make a good king? A good king. I know who'd be a good king. I'd make a pretty good king. I'll be your king. And the people said, no, we don't want you to be our king because your two sons are bums. We will not have your children reign over us. They said, they were bums too. And Samuel says, well, okay. All right, I'll give you a king. And he begins to pray to God, show me who the king should be. And one day, Samuel is watching a group of young men, and one of the young men there is head and shoulders above the others. And Samuel says, that guy, he's pretty tall. I bet he'd be a pretty good king. and he goes over to Saul, and he takes a very important story. He takes a little bit of olive oil, and he pours it on Saul's head and says, "You are anointed the king. God's chosen you to be the king." And Saul becomes the king. But Saul isn't a very effective leader. He's a very weak leader. In practically all the Saul stories, Saul is afraid of something. He's not described so much in this chapter in this way, always called fearful, but at points he's trembling in fear. The bad guys are coming, he starts shaking and trembling. He certainly doesn't portray any kind of courage or convey any kind of courage to his soldiers. He's a very poor leader. And one of the first challenges Saul faces is invasions from the Philistines. The Philistines are a group of people who are moving all over the Mediterranean world. The Egyptians call them the Sea People, S-E-A people, because they come in on boats. It's interesting, when they're portrayed in Egyptian art, they're always taller than the Egyptians are, which is interesting when we look at the story here. Apparently just a big group of people. The Philistines show up. They're highly advanced. They know how to use iron. They have iron technology. And one of the things they do as they move around the Mediterranean world is they forcibly take over the metal business. In fact, in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, we're told that the Philistines disarm the Israelites. The Philistines come in, take all the Israelites' military equipment. In the entire nation, they only leave two swords, one for the king, King Saul, and one for Jonathan, his oldest son, because to take their swords would be too dishonoring to them. Everybody else loses all their military equipment. That's the entire Israeli army, two swords. And Saul doesn't object to this. He goes along with this. He's a very weak leader. At one point in the story, and it would take us too long to go into it, it involves some rituals that are involved in sacrifices. Saul decides to break with some of the rules, to sin. He has what seems to him to be a good reason why he needs to sin. If he sins and goes against what God's told him, see, he figures he'll be able to honor God even more if he does the sacrifices another way. But you never honor God by dishonoring His word. And when Saul goes through that convoluted line of reasoning, I won't do what God told me to do, but if I do it my way, I'll show Him even more honor. And Scripture says that at that point, God just turns His back on Saul. In fact, it says he withdraws his spirit from giving Saul any guidance. It says, okay, you won't think you can do better on your own? Go do it on your own. And it's not long after God removes his spirit that an evil spirit shows up. It's at this point we get introduced to David. In chapter 16, the chapter right before this verse, God tells Samuel, I've given up on Saul. I've turned my back on him. You need to go find another king. And Samuel says, who am I going to find? And God says, well, go to this place called Bethlehem. You'll find a guy there named Jesse. He has some sons. When you get there, I'll tell you which one to anoint. And so Saul goes to Jesse's house. Jesse brings out and says, someone here has been anointed. It's very interesting. Samuel never tells anyone in the family what they've been anointed to do. He just tells them, someone here has been chosen to do a special job. And he leaves it at that. Well, Jesse says, obviously, that's my oldest son. And he sends out the oldest son. And Samuel says, man, that guy's a good-looking guy. I bet he'd make a pretty good king. And God says, no, not that one. The next oldest son comes out. No, not that one. And all the way through the sons, until it looks like they've run out. And Samuel says, are these all your sons? And Jesse says, oh, well, yeah, well, there's a little one. He's out in the field taking care of the sheep. And Samuel says, well, send for him. David shows up, and God says, that's the one, because he's a man after my own heart. And Samuel goes to him and takes a little bit of oil, pours it on David's head, and says, you've been chosen to do a special job. But he doesn't tell David what that job is. Just a short time goes by, and that evil spirit that is tormenting Saul drives Saul mad, drives him insane. And the only thing that can keep him settled down is music. And somebody says, you know, I know this shepherd guy. He's really good with the harp, and he writes some pretty good music. You ought to see if he can get the king to settle down. And who shows up but David? And David begins to play the harp. He begins to play songs that he's written while he's been working as a shepherd. And those songs calmed Saul down. And what were those songs that David was singing? But at least the starting of the Psalms. It's those psalms that can calm him down and settle him. And every once in a while, when Saul's in a bad way, David is sent for. David shows up and sings the psalms to Saul. And we're not explicitly told this, but maybe David says, well, maybe that's what that prophet guy was talking about. Maybe that's that special job that I've been chosen to do. Maybe that's it. And then we come to our story. The Philistine army and the Israelite army are at a stalemate. And you have to understand the first four verses that you have here to understand what's going on and understand why you've got this whole story happening. For some reason, the stories that the two armies have ended up in a situation that neither one wants to be in. They've met in a valley, on opposing hillsides in a valley. A steep hillside with one camp up here at the top of the hill, the other camp on the other top of the hill. Down in the valley, there's a little brook and a flat land and then the very steep hillside. Now, the Israelites end up on one side of the army, on one side of the hill, but they don't want to attack the Philistines because they don't have any weapons. Because the Philistines showed up and said, you got to turn in all your weapons. Now the Philistines are making trouble for them. They got no weapons. But they got to do something. Literally, the Israelite army has shown up with shovels and rakes and hoes and steak knives. Whatever they've got left. They're not going to attack the Philistines. They're not going to attack this army with their shovel. The Philistines don't want to attack either, though. Philistine tactics depended on iron chariots. And you can't start the chariots up at the top of the hill and go charging down the bottom of the steep hill. That's not going to work. And they don't want to attack on foot either, not on that kind of rough terrain. You've got the description here of Goliath's armor, the thick armor, the big leggings on the legs to protect from sword blows. They've got all this armor strapped across the front, a javelin strapped across the back, this big helmet. The last thing you want to do when you got 125 pounds of armor on is go running down a hill at somebody. You got to be on flat land to fight like that. What happens if you got 100 pounds of armor on and you trip over a rock or something and fall down and your enemy's on top of you and you got all that armor on? It doesn't matter if all your enemy's got a rake. You're gone. You can't move. You're got. So the Philistine army doesn't want to move either. And so they sit there in this stalemate. But there's an attempt to break the stalemate. And that's when Goliath shows up. Goliath is described as a giant, a big guy. How tall is he? That's a difficult question. Both the ESV and the NIV the measurements are given in the Hebrew language in cubits. Cubits are notoriously unreliable forms of measurements. There's a range of height that Goliath could be with those numbers. The bottom of that range is 6'8", which is taller than me. Maybe not gigantic, though. The upper end of that range is 11 feet. That's pretty big. An 11-foot tall guy, he can slam the basketball without lifting his hand over his head. That's pretty tall. The translation that we have here has chosen a number in the middle of that range, 9 feet in the middle. There's absolutely no reason to go to the wall arguing for 9 feet instead of 8'11" or something. We don't know exactly. The idea is he's big. Everybody knows that he's big. And he comes down twice a day in the part that we didn't have space for in the news and notes. He comes down twice a day for 40 days. For 40 days, once in the morning, once in the evening, he comes down and hollers at the Israelites, come and get me. With what, their hatchet? A steak knife? Their shovel? And they're stuck. Well, David has three older brothers who are in the camp. And one day, Jesse, the father, tells David, take some food to them. get one of the servants to watch the sheep for the day and go take some food to them. So David shows up. And right when he's about to unload the food off of the wagon, everybody starts hollering because here comes Goliath again. And Goliath starts hollering. And David says, "What's going on?" And his brother says, "Well, he keeps hollering at us for somebody to come fight him." And David says, "Well, why don't you go fight him? You know the Lord's going to give you the victory." And the brothers say, "Well, yeah, you got an interesting theological point there. Who's going to go after this guy?" And David says, "Oh, come on. For 40 days he's been doing this. Come on, somebody's got to go take care of this." And then he hears the reward that the king offers. Tax-free for his whole family. He's going to marry the daughter of the king. This big reward. And he goes around asking everybody, nobody's even, you can all go home for one thing if you kill him. And then you're going to get all that stuff in return. And you know that God's going to give you the victory. Why don't you go fight him? And finally Saul hears. Somebody's here who's excited about this. And Saul sends for David. And David shows up and says, I'll do it. God's going to give whoever does it the victory. Well, I might as well do it and get to marry the daughter of the king. We pick up this part of the story about halfway down the first long line of the back of the... Let me point to it. That's around in here with verse 32. David tells Saul, "Don't worry about a thing," David told Saul. "I'll go fight this Philistine." "Don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There's no way you can go against this Philistine. You're only a boy, and he's been in the army since he was a boy." The boy here might be a bit harsh. It might be just a little bit harsh. Think of it more like a young man. Maybe 17, 18, 19 years old. I mean, he's not really a boy. Your clue to that is that when he finds out that if he kills a giant, he's going to get to marry the king's daughter. And he doesn't say, "Yucky, girls are gross." So we know he's not 9. Okay. 17, 18, or 19, that's a bit more likely. And David says, "Yeah, well, I've been taking care of sheep. And you've been a king for a while. You forgot about hard work. I've had to fight off lions. I've had to fight off bears. God gave me the victory over them. God will give me the victory over Goliath." And finally Saul says, "Well, okay." He gives in. And Saul says, "I'll let you have my armor and my sword. Half the military equipment for the whole army." And in this, and there's no other way to approach it but humorously, David straps on all this armor and he starts walking around and he says, "I can't do this. I'm not used to this. I'm just going to go with my slingshot." And he goes to the brook in the valley there. And he takes 5 stones. It's interesting that he takes 5 stones. If you read in the book of 1 Chronicles, just as a footnote to another story, it just happens to be mentioned that Goliath had 4 brothers, and they're all giants too. Their father's name was Rapha, and he was a big guy too. So he gets 5 stones. You get it? He's going to kill Goliath. But wait a second, that guy's got 4 brothers. They might all come after me too. I better get 4 more stones. He's a confident kid. 5 giants, 5 stones. And he goes there. There's this hollering back and forth. And David lets loose with the sling, and the giant's dead. A slingshot might not be very impressive to us, but it makes an impression on Goliath. Right about here, it makes an impression on Goliath. Goliath's dead. You may have heard the expression, "Don't take a knife to a gunfight." Here's another one. "Don't take a spear to a slingshot fight." And the giants did. And the story goes on from here. The Philistine army responds in panic. They're shocked at this. They turn around and try to run away, but they're trying to run uphill in all that armor. And the Israelites chase them down with hammers, and steak knives, and hatchets, and shovels, and takes care of them. And David becomes the big hero. And eventually David's going to replace Saul as king. You see, that's what David's been chosen to do. Not only to liberate the people from the Philistines, but eventually he's going to become king. That was the introduction. Now for the sermon. But the sermon's short. The sermon is short. 3 points. First of all, David doesn't know what God's chosen for him to do. David doesn't know what he's been anointed to do. He doesn't know what he's been called to do. I can tell you that if you've trusted Jesus Christ as your Savior, then you have been anointed. God's chosen you to do something. He has. God's chosen you to do something. And you might not know what that is. You might not know what that is. How do you find out what God has chosen you to do? You find that out by doing what you already know to do. Because there are some things that everybody's supposed to do. That's how you find out what you're supposed to do. You see, David knows he's supposed to honor his father. And as long as he lives in his father's house, that means he's to obey his father. And his father says, carry some food to your brothers. So David does. And he happens to show up right at the right time. If he'd gotten there 2 hours earlier, unloaded the supplies and gone home, Goliath still might be over there hollering at them. Who knows? You see, the way that God raises up leaders in the church is that he teaches his teaches people to be followers. There's some ministry, there's some work in this church that God is calling you to do, and that eventually you'll move into a leadership position in. And how do you find out what that is? You find that out by following. You find out what that is by doing what you already know what you need to do. The second thing to point out has to do with that humorous bit about the armor. David's been given a tool, a slingshot. God's given you tools to work in ministry. Don't try to borrow other people's tools. Don't wish you had other tools that you don't have. Find out which tools you do have, even if it's a stupid old slingshot. If God's calling you to use that tool, use it to do what God's called you to do. And then the third thing, very obviously, Goliath is bigger than David. Goliath is bigger than David, but he isn't bigger than God. All of our problems are bigger than we are. Well, they are. Well, of course they are. If they were smaller than we are, they wouldn't be problems. All of our temptations are bigger than we are. Of course they are. If they weren't, we wouldn't be tempted by them. The tasks that God calls us to do are bigger than we are. Well, of course they are, or else we would have already done them. You can go home and apply that to your own life. But I'd like to apply it to us here as servants of Christ. We've been given some big tasks. We've been called to do some big things. We've been given the challenge to win the city of Gainesville for Jesus Christ. Now, can we do that? No. There's no way we can do that. That problem's much bigger than us. But that problem's not bigger than God. This church believes that we're called to be a part of forming a new Anglican province in the entire continent of North America. How big is that? Bigger than us. But if that's what God's called us to do, it isn't bigger than God. And when we succeed at it, the temptation to be proud and boastful, well, guess what? That's going to be bigger than we are too. But it won't be bigger than God. So I leave you with a thought as you face those giants in your own life, to do what you already know to do and let God do the heavy lifting. In Jesus' name. Amen.